Greetings, Tacoma. John Doherty here once again for Radio Tacoma's Climate Talk, the place where we talk about everything climate, and always respectfully. I recently watched a documentary called Seaspiracy. It's a documentary about the state of the world's fisheries, and sometimes it's a little hard to distinguish between opinion and fact in a documentary, and that's just fine. That's why we've got our rational facility to sort these things out. We've talked to Chris Rilling previously on this program. He's widely experienced in the world's oceans and fishing, and so here's kind of a rundown on Chris's background. He's got a Bachelor of Science in Marine Biology from Humboldt State. He's a former director of the Fisheries Monitoring and Analysis Division at the Alaska Fisheries Science Center, which runs the North Pacific Observer Program. He's had a lot of practical experience as a crew member and a captain on fishing vessels, fishing for salmon, halibut, and Prince William Sound, and he was one of the first boats to respond to the Exxon Valdez oil spill. He later got himself a Master's of Science in Marine Estuarine and Environmental Science at the Chesapeake Biological Lab at the University of Maryland. He spent many years working with NOAA as a Coastal Management Fellow and a National Marine Fisheries Service with the Sustainable Fisheries. Chris moved to Seattle in 2013, where he served as director of the North Pacific Observer Program and eventually retiring in 2018. So Chris clearly has a wonderful mix of academic background, practical experience in the fisheries, as well as oversight from a regulatory perspective. So we're very fortunate to have Chris with us today. So let's listen in. We're really happy to have Chris Rilling with us today. Chris is I would call him a fisherman for at least part of my description of him. He's got a terrific, an amazing resume. And Chris, thank you for joining us here today. And I'd like to start off by saying, could you just say in one sentence, if you had to, what your career has been all about?
Yeah, well, thanks, John, for having me on. I really appreciate it. I really enjoy your show. I guess in one sentence, I would say that my life has revolved around the ocean, and really not just out of enjoyment, but to ensure that our ocean ecosystem is maintained for generations to come. It's an ongoing process. It requires a lot of work on the part of a lot of people and organizations. And there are, as you know, many, many challenges facing our oceans. And I think that I wanted to devote my career to contributing in some way to making sure our oceans are healthy and productive and diverse in all of its marine life and marine species for generations to come.
Well, I love that term, generations to come, and that really is the nub of things. You talk about a healthy, productive, and diverse ocean for generations to come. So where are we right now? I mean, if we keep on doing what we're doing right now in the ocean, and I'm thinking not only in our fisheries, but with plastic pollution, if we keep on doing what we're doing right now, are we going to have a healthy, productive, diverse ocean for generations to come?
Yeah, that's really a good question, John. And obviously, there are so many problems confronting our oceans today, from climate change being the big one, but also plastic pollution, overfishing, decline in habitat and biodiversity. Yeah, the challenges are immense. And like I said, I think a lot of work remains to be done to ensure that we put ourselves on the right path to a sustainable future for all of our ocean species. And that is something that was recently highlighted in the Netflix show Seaspiracy, where they pointed out a lot of these problems that are confronting our world's oceans, overfishing being a big part of that. And having come from a commercial fishing background, I acknowledge that overfishing is a real serious concern across the world. More and more of our growing population is dependent on protein derived from seafood products. And that has driven the demand up so that fleets around the world have been increasing in size, trying to exploit some of those remaining stocks that are, you know, found on the high seas areas. And a lot of those high seas areas, unfortunately, are not monitored. There's very little oversight or enforcement of any sort of fishery regulations on the high seas. So it's a complex problem. I could go on probably for hours discussing all the ins and outs of the issues of fisheries management and stock sustainability. But suffice it to say that there is a lot of good work going on. And I think especially in the U.S., the U.S. has been a world leader in terms of sustainable management of our living marine resources. And I say living marine resources because it's not just fish stocks that the U.S. is interested in maintaining. And the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, where I spent much of my career, is focused on ensuring that all of those living marine resources are sustained for the future. And that means species such as whales, dolphins, sea turtles, seals, marine mammals, et cetera, but also the fish stocks that are important for, as I mentioned, human food and sustaining a growing global population.
So one of the things you mentioned there, Chris, and I think there was a little question mark on it. You said you used the term on the right path. And as I listen to you, it kind of seems to me that we are, and just speaking of the worldwide fishery, the ocean worldwide, I mean, the ocean's a little bit like the atmosphere in that there's not a lot of boundaries. There are some, but there's a lot of ocean out there that isn't owned by anybody. So are we or aren't we on the right path in terms of generational sustainability for the ocean?
Yeah. Again, I think it depends on where you look at those boundaries. So in the Netflix series Seaspiracy, Netflix show Seaspiracy, they really focused on the problem areas. It was tugging at your heartstrings in terms of saying, you know, it's all lost. It's all hopeless, and there's really no future is misleading, I think, at best. And I think you really have to delve into the literature and the work that's being done by not just the U.S., but partners around the world through regional fishery management organizations that are all over the world helping to maintain some of those international fish stocks. But really, I think that the problems often start closer to home. So in the U.S. and most countries around the world, we have a 200-mile exclusive economic zone. And that area is only available to U.S. fishermen. There are no foreign fleets that fish inside of our 200-mile EEZ, is the acronym, exclusive economic zone, that was established in 1983. The U.S. has done a really good job of maintaining our stocks, rebuilding some of our overfished stocks in the U.S. EEZ. And don't just rely on my words for this. You can go to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's website. They're a really good resource for looking at what the status of current both fish stocks and marine mammal stocks and other endangered species like sea turtles and some seabirds, how those populations are faring. And just to give you an example of the 321 stocks that we have information for, 93% of those are not experiencing overfishing, according to NOAA's latest report. They publish a status of the nation's fisheries report every year that you can look at online. And of the 244 stocks that we have really reliable information on, 81% of those are not overfished. And those numbers are increasing. They're improving every year because we have, for one, laws that require stocks to be rebuilt if we find that they're being overfished. Now, that law is referred to as the Magnuson-Stevens Fishery Conservation and Management Act. It was first implemented in 1976 and has been reauthorized several times since then. And it establishes a science-based process for fisheries management in the U.S. And that process, I believe most people that are really involved in the fishery management process, including fishermen, will say that that has been a positive step forward in terms of managing our living marine resources within the US EEZ. Is there still some work to do? Yes. You know, we're not at 100% of stocks not experiencing overfishing. We're not at 100% of stocks not overfished, but that's the goal. And I think continuing to do the research, improve our technologies, improve our fishing gears, improve collaboration between NOAA and fishermen and NGOs, play a huge role in this as well in terms of looking to the future and how to best reduce our impact on the ocean and its resources while also maintaining harvests, is a goal that a lot of people are seeking. And I think we will get there. But again, so here I was focusing on the U.S. EEZ. If you step beyond that boundary and look at the high seas, it's a different picture. As you mentioned, there really are no boundaries when you're out there, and it's not controlled, and there is little, if any, enforcement. And this was an area that the Seaspiracy movie really highlighted. And I couldn't agree more that there needs to be international accountability. And it's not to say that NOAA and the U.S. government, the U.S. Coast Guard aren't trying to do that. We are partners in a number of different regional fishery management organizations across the world, trying to both hold ourselves accountable, but also other countries that are fishing on the high seas. And I think that's really where the outlook at the moment is not encouraging. These are the issues that were highlighted in the Seaspiracy movie.
Yeah, well, thanks for that great summary. And I mean, it is good to know, especially with your background, that in the United States, we're doing a pretty good job. We're not doing perfectly, but we're doing pretty good. One of the things I wonder about, this is just kind of a technical question. The 200-mile limit that you talked about, does this 200-mile limit apply to all countries around the world?
I believe most countries of the world have established an EEZ. I don't know that they're all 200 miles. Some areas, like you hear about the conflict in the Straits of Taiwan between China and Taiwan and between China and the Philippines, sometimes there isn't a 200-mile buffer there. And so the boundary gets drawn halfway down the middle, and that ends up perhaps being less than 200 miles in many cases.
Yeah. So I guess a summary of what you've said so far is that probably some of the economically powerful democratic countries in the world are doing a pretty good job. But once we get beyond that, we're kind of getting into the wild, wild west, it seems. Is that seems somewhat accurate?
Yeah, I think you're right. So I guess the advantage that we have in the U.S. is our U.S. fleets, I believe, are really at their heart trying to do the right things. You know, let's take the tuna fishery, for example. For many years, U.S. fishermen used to purse seine in the eastern tropical Pacific for tuna. And the way they fish for tuna was they would actually set on the dolphins, which aggregate with the tuna. So you'll see the dolphins at the surface. That means there were tuna under the surface. And the purse seiners would set the purse seine around the dolphins without even really seeing the tuna. And that resulted in very high mortality rate of dolphins for many, many years. This is in the 60s and 70s. And the U.S. government, fishery management organizations, NGOs all became active in trying to reduce the dolphin bycatch. So laws were enacted, and especially the Dolphin Safe Tuna program that was established through various NGOs working together, had a really dramatic impact in reducing the total number of dolphin mortalities per year. U.S. vessels there are very limited number of U.S. purse seine vessels, just a handful at this point, where at one point there were 30 or more. Many of them have unfortunately been driven out of the business because it isn't as easy to catch tuna if you're not setting on dolphins. But U.S. fishermen did the right thing and largely got out of that fishery. But then that created a vacuum where other countries came in and unfortunately, probably to this day, are still setting on dolphins in order to catch tuna. So that's just one example where U.S. fishermen, I think, did the right thing. The U.S. followed up in terms of trying to document where those dolphin mortalities were taking place. And then that had some real economic repercussions for some of those U.S. tuna fleets. The challenge now is how to get other countries that are still tuna purse seining to come into the similar types of compliance. So I think that's the challenge, is trying to get other countries to enact laws similar to what the United States has and actually monitor and enforce those requirements. So you have vessels on the high seas that are fishing indiscriminately, laying out perhaps miles and miles of gill nets. Well, that catch is going somewhere. I can guarantee you that catch isn't coming directly to the United States. It's going to countries overseas, largely, I believe, Asian countries, but also some of Central and South American countries. And what really needs to happen is, just like in the U.S., when a vessel comes in to offload its catch, there needs to be appropriate documentation of where that catch was taken, were the appropriate permits in place, was the correct gear used, and was there any bycatch? And that requires perhaps having observers on board, having good logbook records provided by the captain, and that sort of thing. And I think that type of oversight is unfortunately missing in a lot of countries of the world.
Yeah, it seems like there's a common challenge. I can see a parallel with one company's polluting and another company decides to do the right thing and doesn't pollute. And now they're at a somewhat of a financial disadvantage. And then you look at the seas, as you point out there, if the U.S. fishermen are doing, as you say, the right thing, then somebody else can make a profit doing the wrong thing. It's just an unfortunate phenomenon. And I guess it just requires eternal effort and eternal vigilance and a vision to make things better looking downstream. So one of the things, there's a lot of public interest, of course, in dolphins because, well, we just like dolphins. And people want to buy tuna fish that is really has respected the dolphins during the catch process. So how can a consumer be confident that they are getting tuna fish that's been fished with the dolphins in mind?
I think there are a number of things that a responsible consumer would do. One would be to, as I mentioned early on, go to the fishwatch.gov website. This is run by NOAA, and they list every stock imaginable, every stock that's being harvested, what the current management measures are that are in place for that fishery, whether the stock is overfished, whether overfishing is occurring, et cetera, et cetera. You can go there and look for whatever species of tuna you might be interested in consuming to find out what the status of that stock is. So that's one way. Go to the internet and do some research. Don't just rely on one site. I think there's been some controversy about some of the certifications that are out there by NGO groups that are trying to monitor whether tuna is dolphin safe. Don't rely on just one. There are a number of different sources you can go to, like Monterey Bay Aquarium, for instance, has a fish watch program. MSC, Marine Sustainability Council, is another one. That's the one that has recently come under some controversy for perhaps not being as rigorous as they had in the past for some stocks. Don't rely on a single source. Look at multiple sources. One thing to remember for U.S. authorized harvest and U.S. stocks, as I mentioned at the outset, those are governed under the Magnuson-Stevens Fishery and Conservation Management Act. And even if a stock is experiencing overfishing, management measures have been put into place to ensure that that stock is sustainable in the future. So some harvest can still be occurring for both overfished stocks and stocks that are experiencing overfishing within the U.S. But it just means that the harvest rate or the total harvest has been reduced depending on whether it's overfishing or overfished. So even though a stock might be overfished in U.S. waters, it's still okay to consume the fish that's being legally harvested under a fishery management plan. I don't know whether the same could be said for some of the international stocks. And this is where some of those NGO certifications come into play. You need to find out where those fish are being harvested, what types of gear they're being harvested with, and whether they're in compliance with any sort of fishery management regulations.
Okay, well, that all sounds like great advice. We will have some show notes, and I'll put some links to some of the organizations that you mentioned there, including the fishwatch.gov. And one of the things that's real clear listening, Chris, is that as with so much these days, we got to do our homework. You just can't assume that things are okay. For one thing, there's a lot of folks out there that are intent on kind of deceptive practices. And so your guidance to look for more than one source and do your homework seems like absolutely required for people who care. One of the things you mentioned early on was impacts of climate change in the ocean. And so we are a climate show. So could you talk a bit about what you see going on in terms of climate change in the ocean?
Yeah, it's a really profound and challenging problem. I mean, even here in Puget Sound area, we have concerns and problems with some of our native fish stocks. It's no mystery that the Chinook salmon populations are in severe decline and actually in risk of going extinct. They're currently listed, Puget Sound Chinook is listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act. The forecast for run returns this year is still very dismal. There are obviously a lot of problems that sort of lend themselves to that overfished stock. They range from both habitat loss in some of our major streams and rivers and tributaries to hydropower projects on the Snake and the Columbia, which impact, you know, fish, at least Chinook salmon's ability to get upstream to spawn. And we also have climate. I mean, some scientists believe that the warming conditions in the northern Pacific are a big part of the reason that some of our native fish stocks are not doing well. You probably have heard in recent years about a warm blob that has come up into the North Pacific from the El Nino event. Have you heard about that, John?
Yeah, absolutely. I have. Yeah. Although, tell more.
Well, so what happens in the ocean ecosystem is you are really dependent on upwelling currents, nutrient-laden upwelling occurring on the West Coast, which brings nutrients from the deep sea to the surface waters where then all that great productivity begins, right? You get the phytoplankton that blooms that begin because they have the nutrients that they need to grow, and then that feeds up the food chain through zooplankton, small fish stocks like anchovies and sardines, all the way up to Chinook salmon and ultimately our orca, which obviously are very dependent on Chinook salmon. But if you have warm water events, it's like putting a cap on top of a current. It sort of blocks that cold nutrient-rich water from rising to the surface and can really diminish the productivity of our coastal waters. And I think that's been a contributing factor, at least in recent years, to salmon survival, because when the smolts, young salmon, come out of our river systems and from our hatcheries, and let's face it that a vast majority of the Chinook salmon in Puget Sound are now hatchery reared. The wild stocks are only a fraction of the total population. But when these young salmon come out of the river systems, they need food. And if the primary productivity isn't happening because of a warm blob putting a cap on that nutrient-rich water rising to the surface, then that can have a really detrimental impact on these young salmon. So that's obviously a symptom, sign of climate change, that we're having more of these warm water events happening in the North Pacific and other oceans of the world. Another big factor in terms of climate change is increasing our river and stream temperatures. And there's a point at which salmon will no longer be capable of spawning if the water temperature rises above a certain point. So you have both warming of some of our river systems due to warmer temperatures. You also have declining water tables because, as we all know, droughts are now a common everyday, every year event in the Northwest. So that reduces flows in streams that salmon are really dependent on. So you have to have a combination of high flow to keep the temperatures down and also to provide suitable habitat for salmon, both as they're going upstream to spawn and then also as they're out-migrating to ensure their survival to make it to the ocean. So we're putting a lot of stumbling blocks in the way of our local native salmon populations. You know, and let's not forget, we have a growing population in the Pacific Northwest, too. And where does everyone want to live? Everyone wants to live on the coast with the beautiful view of Puget Sound or a river. And so we've sort of infringed upon and removed a lot of the habitat that these salmon used to rely on. We tend to straighten streams so that we can build houses next to them. We remove trees, and that removes the shade cover and the natural woody debris that salmon rely on for refuges, for habitat when they're in these stream systems. So it's not as simple as just pointing at climate being the one issue that's impacting our Chinook salmon populations. We all play a part in it because we're all part of the human impact on the environment.
Yeah. So one of the things I'm picking up from some of your description there, Chris, as a layperson, it's easy for me to go on the coast or be boating, and it's just like, okay, this is just a whole bunch of water. But the thing is, it's an incredibly dynamic system, and small changes can have drastic results in terms of currents and things related to that. And that takes me back to the place where I've been earlier in our conversation. That is, these problems that we're facing are not simple, and there aren't any simple solutions. And we do have to, as concerned citizens, we have to take the effort to understand with some detail what's going on. We're just not looking at a 30-minute situation comedy here where there's a problem. Oh, there's a solution. Good. We're good to go. So the challenge is ahead. And I'm referring back once again to your earlier phrase of generations to come. The challenge is all over the place, and seeing that these things are related, that how we live, you know, where we live, what our lifestyles are like, what our energy sources are, they're impacting everything all over the world. And we live in an interlaced system, and once again, no easy solutions. So I think we're getting close to the end here, Chris. I've been asking the questions. Anything else that we haven't talked about that you would like to put on the table here?
Well, let's see. We didn't really talk much about plastic waste. So that microplastics in particular are becoming a really big problem. The Seaspiracy movie points to derelict fishing gear as being a major problem. I think they focus on that perhaps a little too exclusively to the larger problem of our dependency on plastics when it comes to everything that we buy. I mean, it's hard to find anything these days that we buy that doesn't have plastic on it, but that's what people should be looking for. Buy products that aren't wrapped in plastic. Insist that grocery stores not use plastic bags, because ultimately most of that or a lot of that will end up in the ocean, not just fishing gear. So I think I think we all need to make changes where we can. And like another one, for instance, would be, I still see lots and lots of people using pesticides and herbicides and lawn fertilizer to keep lawns green. Even here in the Northwest, where, you know, do you really need a lawn fertilizer? And that results in nutrients going into our river systems and ultimately into Puget Sound, which can cause eutrophication or a buildup of nutrients that then cloud the water and diminish, for instance, seagrasses from being able to grow. This was a really well-documented problem in the Gulf of Mexico and Chesapeake Bay that ultimately results in dead zones, because you have these phytoplankton blooms that occur and then sink to the bottom and create oxygen depleted zones. We don't want to get to a point like that in Puget Sound. So I think the message I would give to people is make the small changes wherever you can. reduce your use of plastics, pesticides, herbicides, nitrogen fertilizers that you want to put on your lawn, because all of that has an impact on our salmon and our orca ultimately. So there are things we can do. Sometimes they start small. They might seem small, but if we do them cumulatively across broad swaths of our population, which I don't think has happened yet, that's when you can begin to see changes happening and improvements being made.
Yep, I get that, Chris. And I like your point about reducing, because sometimes I look at, just plastic consumption. I mean, I work to reduce my plastic consumption. I can be discouraged by thinking, well, how can I live in this society, this economic system, without consuming plastic? And the answer is I really can't, but that doesn't mean that I can't reduce significantly my use of plastic or the other things like pesticides and fertilizers that you talk about. I'm pretty happy to say that my yard has gone pretty natural. I live on a sloping hill and don't use any chemicals on my yard at all. And I love my yard. It's a beautiful yard. So we don't have to do those things to
exactly
enjoy our homes. And I will throw out, I mean, while this individual behavior is important, I think that eventually or ultimately we have to look to government policies to set the big picture on what we do with pollutants and other things like that. So, Chris, this is the second time we've chatted. I really enjoy talking with you. It's so great to talk to somebody with the tremendous history and background that you've got on the ocean, your concern for keeping the ocean productive for us and clean is obvious, and I really appreciate that. And so thanks once again for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you, John. It's been great being on your show.
Well, there you have it. Great talking with Chris. Check out the show notes at ccltacoma.org for some of the links that Chris mentioned. And I'd love to hear from you via email, John, J-O-H-N, at ccltacoma.org. I appreciate every note that I receive. So that's it for today. Just a reminder of a couple things. We got to do our homework. We got to be engaged to deal with all of the multifarious ecological, climatological issues that we're facing as a species. And also, in the meantime, always remember, live like the mountain is out. Take care now.